This is a Gathering Heritage project interview recorded in County Louth in Ireland.
Now, I'm speaking to Joe Martin in the comfort of his house here in Dublin Street in Dundalk. And Joe was very much involved, like an awful lot of us, way back, I'm going to say the 40s and 50s, I hope I have the dates right. But we're going to talk a little while about a man that came from the same street, actually, as Joe, Dublin Street in Dundalk. And his name was Joe McEntee. Joe, there'd be none of the young people would have any idea of Joe McEntee. Just in a few words, before we start talking about all the things that he was involved in, how would you describe him?
A living saint, Harry. A living saint, but a strange man until you got to know him. He was born in number 57 Dublin Street, and four doors from where I lived. But I think it was the late 20s or early 30s that the council decided to change the numbers on the doors in Dublin Street. I was born in number 3, but it was 49 when I was born then, you see. And McEntee's were number 7, and they never changed the number. They wouldn't change it for the council. Well, Joe came from a family of 6. He had 5 brothers and 1 sister. They were real good people, like, you know. One of them was a brother. He was stationed in Galway, and Barney was married to a dentist, very, very old when he got married in the 40s. Michael married in Dublin, and James worked in the brewery. And Joe worked in the railway until it closed, and then he was a security man in the brewery.
So, Joe, what would make somebody that lives in a house like that in Dublin Street, just an ordinary man, start up something like the Joe's Boys Club? How did it start at the very beginning?
I'll tell you how it started. There was a team called St. Malachy's, and they used to had a room up in Casey's Shack in a wee place before Oriel Park. And Joe was at a minor game, St. Malachy's were playing in, and I don't know who asked him, would he run the team? So Joe said yes, and after a few weeks, he found out that there was a loft in O'Connell's Yard in Dublin Street. That is where the road is now, going to Tesco's. That was one big house there, and a big yard, and he rented that. And they had to go up a ladder to it until they got stairs. And Joe started a club there, a minor club, football club. And he called the club Cinderville. The reason why he called it Cinderville was when he was young, along with Kevin Brennan from Wins Terrace, they had a team called Cinderville playing at the Cinder Track in Thomas Street, before Thomas Street was ever Thomas Street. Mm. Well, they got the stairs up, and he had Cinderville, and I said to Tony Doughty, this was about late 30s of 1940, I said to Tony Doughty in 1941, there's a new club started, will we join it? He says, we will. I'll go in first and then you come in. And it was mostly like there were Jimmy McAvoy and fellas that were 4 or 5 years older than us. We were young at the time, very young. But
at this stage, Joe, it was just football.
There was not just football, at this stage. He had a team called Cinderville in the football. And on my 11th birthday, I played under 14 in Oriel Park for the first time for Cinderville. And scored 2 goals, and Joe said, you're on your way. Now, Joe McEntee had the football team, and he was well before his time. Before every game, Harry, he'd have a whole line out of the teams. Few things I'll tell you about. Goalkeeper, corner kicks, you are out if the ball's outside the penalty spot. Winger, taking the corners, make sure they're between the penalty spot and the 18-yard line. Full backs, mind your posts. He went through every position to tell us all. And he was a genius that way. But if you ever played again, he'd kill you. He was nuts.
He was very passionate, wasn't he?
Oh, he'd kill you, Harry. He went. But the club started then, and we had nothing in it. Then he got a three-quarter size snooker table. We had a small snooker table, and I think it was a penny to play in it, like, you know. And Joe was putting all his own money into the club because we had no way of getting any money. From a three-quarter size snooker table to a full size and a three-quarter size, then a table tennis table. And that was the start of the club, which we all learned our snooker and our table tennis in Joe McEntee's. But one thing we didn't learn was how to run out the door when he started a rosary at 11 o'clock at night, and none of us would stay behind.
We were still talking about him being up in Dublin Street.
In Dublin Street in O'Connell's Yard, yeah. Yes. Yeah, but he was a very religious man, a daily communicant. He went to 7 Mass in the Friary every morning, and we'd go from Mass then up to his job in the railway. He was a I don't know what he was. He wasn't a tradesman in the railway, but I used to say to him, "Joe, you don't do any work in the railway. Once you get your number and you go inside that door, they have you for that 8 hours, and you don't care if you do nothing or not." That's the way he was. Yeah. Talking about where he got the money from, after a year or two, he decided that he'd start a fife and drum band because he knew Harry Whiting, who worked in the railway, and he was a bandmaster in the British Army during the First World War, and very, very talented, and his favourite. He was a bandmaster of the Emmett Band before they see and give it up, but was fife and drum. Well, fife and drum suited us because Joe were the cheapest instrument to get. And we bought one fife, and we'd all sit practicing, bucket of cold water, dip the flute into it, so you'd hand it to the other fellow, we would be spitting his spits. So eventually we got a whole lot of things, and Joe started saying, we'll run a concert. We run a concert and try and get some money in to get drums and more instruments. And he had about 20 in the band at him. Now, I'm only talking as the youngster. Oliver Crossan and all them were 4 or 5 years older than me. And I was nothing, like, you know. Yeah. I was nothing. And we had a concert. And who was at the concert? Only Bill Russell. And Joe was giving a speech thanking everyone who came to the show. And he says, "I want to tell you something. Some people say Bill Russell's a bum. He's not a bum. He's after buying us 4 new drums."
Now, just to let our listeners know, Bill Russell, Russell's Saloon in Dublin Street.
In Park Street.
Yeah. And my great memory of that place was when we were kids, the only place that put up the result of the games that Dundalk were playing all over the country.
Over it.
Yeah, indeed. So that was Bill Russell.
Still there. Well, anyway, then another great idea came into Joe's head that he designated some of the younger me and Johnny McInfoy and Mickey McCone. We had streets that we used to go round every Friday with our book. I had St. Malachy's Villas and get threepence of all the neighbours. And 90% of them would give the money because they knew it was going to a good cause. And big laugh for you, Harry. He was after being presented with a picture of a mother of perpetual succour. He says, "That would be a wonderful way to get money. We'll have a raffle." So we bought about 10 cloakroom tickets. 10 books of cloakrooms. And he gave one to me and Johnny McFoy. We designated to go to Quay Street. So we were afraid of our life to go to Quay Street at that time. So that was worse than Hill Street. And down we went, selling, will you buy a ticket for the raffle of this picture? I had to say that, and we'd hand up the... Oh, they're cloakroom tickets. You're not supposed to be selling them. Just put your name in them, ma'am, I'd say. And then I'd go to the next door. Will you buy a picture for the raffle of this ticket? I didn't know where it was. Well, we were terrified coming up at that time. You come up the street and not be afraid, not like now. And actually, the night, big night, was the night of the raffle. We were there on a Sunday all around. Pam McMahon, he was the secretary, and got the big drum and put them in. But what did Joe do? All the cloakroom tickets that wasn't sold, he stamped in St. Joseph's Boys Club. You see, he changed it. I'll tell you about why he changed it to St. Joseph's Boys Club. And he stamped in St. Joseph's Boys Club, and he says, he pulled something up, pull out the tickets. Ticket, St. Joseph's Boys Club, make it 3 tickets. St. Joseph's Boys Club, 4 passes. You can't do that. You're going to keep the picture. That's not fair. And we all said, oh, yeah, you know, you can't do that, Joe. Well, I'll do it once more, he says. And then goes the drum, and out comes the ticket. St. Joseph's Boys Club. Our lady must want us to win this picture, so we are keeping it. And it was up in the club ever after that.
Now, Joe, getting to the band, had they got uniforms at this stage?
No uniforms. But eventually, we... believe it or not, the railway men were very, very kind to the Joe's Club. Joe was very popular in the railway. And he used to collect the dem every week. They might give him a shilling each, like, and it was a lot of money. And we got enough... We went down the town just... We got 40 caps. We'd only a cap on us. And Joe said we'd go down the town and advertise. And Joe was walking down the town. And we were playing one march is all we had. And it was called First Attempt. We played it 45 times, go down the town. But when we were coming down by the Home of Cologne, you know there, down Park Street.
Yeah.
Yeah. Joe went down Francis Street and we went down and he had a run.
he was the leader.
He was leading him with the stick, you see.
Yeah.
So then we went, remember the tweed factory, I think it was called Taylor's, and we got all the uniforms made. And we
The band, of course, was very successful because the my memory of them is when the Cardinal or anything would arrive at Hill Street Bridge, the Joe's band was all part and parcel of that. But there was then, Joe, the place itself in up to O'Connell Yard, which is up by the handy stores up there.
Yeah.
And he put loads of concerts and everything on up there in the building, didn't he?
Well, we had the concert... Joe would think nothing of saying it's retained for another week. He didn't care who, like a powerful artist. He had Billy McAllister who worked in the railroad with him, Mr. Malloy,
yeah.
their father, and he played the violin. Did Jimmy Bell, the Irish tenor. Jimmy was very good in the club, but he was in the band too, and we had all of them in the band, and we had a show on one night. And all of a sudden, the public, the guards or someone came and said, "We have to close this down because it's too dangerous with all the people. If it were a fire, we'd all be burned to death." And Joe was raining. He said, "There's 5th columnists in this town to see, and I know who they are. I'm not telling you who he thought they were." So we transferred the show to the railway hall then, and. By the way, not taken away from Joe, but Barney McGill was the man who put on the shows.
Yeah.
And he had great ideas. He was very good. Would you like to swing in the star? Mm-mm. And he'd be singing. And my job was, we'd a black and white minstrel scene. Am I allowed to say that? I used to collect the corks in the wee house in Ann Street and burn them and put on her face.
We are moving on now, Joe, to a huge thing that Joe did was the Joe's football football field. Yeah.
Well, by this time, Harry, we moved from O'Connell's yard down to O'Connell in Ann Street. Now, which was more handy for me because this time I was living in Ann Street, just walk across the road.
Sorry, Joe, I said the wrong thing a few minutes ago there when we were talking about Connell's in there in Dublin Street. Yeah. I said putting the home bake or the handy stores, but now it's moved
now
down to
now
that.
Now we're in the handy stores, yeah. And the name is... I'll tell you how the name St. Joseph's came. We decided in 1943, we don't like Cinderville, Joe. We'll change it. Well, he says, this is in Dublin. I'm back in Dublin Street again. And he says, right, what will we have? He says, hey, what about your name, Joe, St. Joseph? Not after you, but you're very fond of St. Joseph's Church in the Dock. Not a bad. And so he changed it to St. Joseph's. And there was some kind of a row going on then in 1945. Like, I don't know what, with the bigger fellas, you know. And Joe said, I'm closing the club. Oh, so we were all sad. Joe's closing the club. What are we going to do? And he came back the next night and a general meeting. And we all thought it was the end of the club. So, see, I went to bed last night. And I tell you what, St. Gerard appeared to me and said, do not close this club because you're doing great work. And so I'm not closing the club. And there was a big cheer. So that was the first miracle I ever heard of.
So how did he get the money and the leases and everything for the pitch up there? Which was beside Oriel Park, this side of Oriel Park.
Well, the Joe's Park, a good story about that. Joe heard it was for sale. And who owned? Only Frank's, the barber, at Market Square, and Joe went down and he rented it to him. And then it was all, see, they worked on the railway, Harry. They probably got the goalposts and all made there and the nets and all that and got the palings round it and all. I tell you, the chaps, the tradesmen in the Joe's Club, there was an awful lot of them, they all did the work, like, you know. And they put down the Joe's Park. And Not satisfied with that, what had he in front of the Joe's Park? Only a 9-hole pitch and putt. And there's where a lot of money came from, Harry.
Joe, I spent many's a brilliant Sunday morning up walking in that, in the wee hut, for sixpence for a round of pitch and putt. Yeah. I remember that so well. But Joe, people have no idea how big a place that was for the Summer League and the games of a Sunday night there at 7 o'clock kickoff.
There'd be a couple of thousand at them, Harry. I'm not exaggerating. Like, and he got two buses out of the railway that were spent for dressing rooms, like, and all this. In the long run, I think it was in the early 50s, Franks wanted to sell Oriel Park, and Joe, I think it was Paddy McMahon's father, was representing us at the Summer League meetings, and he said, Joe's Park is up for sale, and say there was 10 clubs, it's only going to cost £300. Now, £300 was an awful lot of money then. He didn't get one club to say they'd pay the £30 it was, like, you know. And Joe kind of lost interest then. Like, he says, they want me to do everything. And Joe used to cut the field. He used to do everything. But he used to love up doing the job you're doing, collecting. He used to love doing that. But Joe's Park was the home of Summer League football in the 50s and 60s.
Joe, what year then did the split happen?
With who?
With Joe's club.
I'll tell you how that happened. Now, I wasn't so much involved with the Joes after I started playing with Dundalk in 1949, so I hadn't got the time. And then I was in love, Harry. I was courting, and I wouldn't be in the club as often as I used to be. But seemingly there was a meeting and Joe made a rule. He made his own rules, Harry. Nobody who's a member of this club can play with any other summer league team. Now, Frankie Whitmarsh and Benny McGuinness and all that said, that's not right. And what did they do? They left the Joes and formed Arsenal Club across facing them.
And I have to admit, Joe, I went with them.
And I was with them too, yes. Believe it or not. And Mickey McCone and Johnny McCone. There was nothing against the Joes. But if I can if you can understand, Harry, the older people like us, that we were the old members then, they were nearly all drifting away. And younger people were coming in that we didn't know so much. You know? But the Arsenal and the Joes, the story I have to tell about that is in 1959, the Summer League decided that old professionals like Joe Ralph and myself, the Summer League could play one player on each team. I'm standing at the Handy Stores one night and Joe was closing the club. I was talking to Mickey McCone and Francie Callan and some of them and here's Joe coming. I said, Joe, I want to see you. What's wrong, Joe? We're still best of friends, like, you know. He says, do you want me to play in the Summer League? I was just waiting to see would you ask. I wasn't going to ask you. Yes, certainly. And it transpired then that by doing that, I was made manager of the Joes team. And Mona had to wash the jerseys and everything. And
it was great, though, at getting people to do stuff.
And I played one day and I got four ribs. Paddy Chevron broke four of me ribs and I couldn't let on because she would have killed me for playing.
Now, Joe, moving on, unfortunately, it's very difficult in the space of time we have to talk over all the things. But when when did Joe die?
He died in 1967, age 59. But one of his greatest achievements was someone suggested, Joe, why don't you go up for the council? Oh, you'd be able to go up as an independent, you'd be able to get all the things that you want. So he was going up for the council and the council results were coming out. And I was playing against Shamrock Rovers and got me nose broken. I landed in the Manor Hospital and missed all the fun. He was elected. He was elected. And he had some great sayings. I still say the sayings. He said, they had a playground below in Clunenda. You know, a children's playground. But the fellas, the young fellas, 17 and 18, were going home at night and causing awful, awful rows and trouble in it. And Joe McEntee, they objected to the council. And Joe McEntee got up. And I still see it in the Democrat. The Lordy Dawes from Clunenda want to close the children's ground. And anyone says to me, she's a Lordy Dawes, she's from Clunenda.
And Joe, he's very famous too for the cherry trees.
Oh, well they made a laugh of the cherry trees. Now, Jimmy Bellier, to give him his due, Joe went to the cherry trees and I made a wee song about what's woe with me, says Joe McEntee. Think we'll have some cherry trees and we'll have the salt to see from Dog to John's Key and then we'll have homegrown cherry tree. It's just a tree for me. Well, the trees, Jimmy Bell, 5 or 6 years after his death, got McEntee Avenue named after him. That's at Pierce Park. And the most beautiful sight you ever see now is the cherry trees. But everyone thought, we were all dumb. We talked about cherry fruit, and they are the loveliest sight. They're lovely when they're in bloom, yeah.
And Joe, I've just noticed the other day, and I'm talking to you now, in May in 2019, and I was passing it the other day knowing I was going to talk to you, and somebody should go up, and I'm going to approach the council about this and put a plaque up that can be read.
And like before we finish, the mass that we'd have, yeah. I feel an awful hypocrite because I'm not a mass goer now. But like I'm doing that must be 12 to 15 years anyway, and he was 50 years dead 2 years ago. And it's held in the Friary on nearest thing. It's on the 26th of August this year. And I hope I have the courage to do it again. But like Joe McEntee used to take us to Salterstown on the bike. He used to take us to Butlins. He's a wonderful man, he was.
And Joe, it reminds me, the Mass reminds me, which I have gone up now for a good few years with you, and about the song Waltzing Matilda, because every year you get up, or the priest gets up, and they say the people that passed on, the members of the Joe's Club, and they're getting smaller and smaller, the crowds,
There's only about five left, I'm telling you. That's all we have. It's a terror, and I look down and half of them are all crippled like myself, not able to walk.
Do you feel, now talking about it, Joe, I know you're very passionate and you talk about things in your own inimitable way, and do you feel sad, though, when you think back that he died so young? And other than us, and we, this is why we're doing these kind of interviews, that we at least people can listen to the memory of when we are all long gone.
Up to 53, he was laid out there. I went up to see him. He was in Newcastle Sanatorium outside of Dublin. He had cancer. He was an awful man for the cigarettes. He'd smoke 20 a day. And during the war on a Sunday morning, where cigarettes were scarce, I used to run up to McDermott's Terrace for 20 cigarettes and give me one and sixpence and I get 3 halfpence for myself back, and I was made up then. But like, no, it was very, he had a very hard death, but like he was the only man I ever heard. I was in Skerry's with him one day with a few fellas, and I said, Joe, what do you think about dying? Joe, he says, I wish I was dying tomorrow. I can't wait to get to heaven. And that was like, he was 20 years before he died, probably, like, you know. But he was always very holy. And he had a what would you call him? We had our own seats on the Monday night Holy Name Saturday in the Friary, St. Joseph's Boys Club, and we all used to go there and sing, We Stand for God and for His Glory. Oh, for God's sake.
He was a wonderful, wonderful. And he did so much, Joe, for when you see all the trouble there is now these days with young teenagers. We were so lucky to have somebody like Joe McEntee.
Well, I tell you why I was so lucky. All I did in my own house was eat me breakfast, dinner, and tea. I was in the club all the other nights. Why? Because big roaring fire in the middle of the war years. People wouldn't understand. No lights in the street. And that's where we spent our time. Newcomers all singing. Paddy Taggart from Legion Avenue, he was up and he was a new singer. And he sang Bantry Bay and Joe, first prize, because he loved the Irish song. And I was supposed to be singing, and I'd sing, no, I don't want you, I don't want you singing. And I got up the next time and sang Galway Bain. No good, no good.
He was very opinionated anyway.
I'll tell you one thing about songs. Beautiful Dreamer was his favourite song. He was the worst piano player ever lived. And he'd bang it on a Sunday morning. Beautiful dream. But he loved Al Jolson and Bing Crosby singing The Spaniard That Blighted My Life. And I was playing with the B team and went into Woolworths in Henry Street and saw the record, big record, and I carried it to the football because you did break easily then. I think I paid a half a crown for it and I brought it home. I said, that's the best present I ever got. And he put it on. He put it on 100 times. The Spaniard that played me late. Oh.
Well, Lord have mercy on him. And I hope he rests in peace. Yeah. And there were lovely memories, Joe. And thank you very much indeed for talking.
I enjoyed it, Harry. Sure, I'm stuttering like usual. No matter.
That was Joe Martin. And, you know, you do feel very emotional because we spent so many years in those vulnerable years where so many of the kids now, and nobody has any idea. That was only a very small little idea or things that Joe was talking about. There was loads of other things as well. But thank you very much, Joe. Thank you.
Listen to lots more epic interviews at gatheringheritage.com.